This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Staying home to raise a child is work that is not financially rewarded. In fact, it's often financially penalized. That penalty is the subject of the book, The Price of Motherhood. My guest is the author, Ann Crittenden. She left her job as a reporter for the New York Times in the early 80s after the birth of her son. Her new book is inspired by personal experiences, and it's informed by more than 5 years of research in economics, sociology, child development, family law, and public policy, as well as interviews with parents. Crittenden says that changing the status of mothers by gaining real recognition of their work is the great unfinished business of the women's movement. She's concluded that motherhood is the single biggest risk factor for poverty in old age. I asked her why.
Well, the vast majority of mothers take some time out of the labor force to raise their families. And every time, for every year you spend at home, working at home rather than working in the marketplace, you get no Social Security credits, or you reduce your Social Security credits if you're working part-time and so forth. So women, older women, have far, far lower pensions, lower Social Security pensions than anyone else, older mothers, I should say.
Something I found very interesting in your book is about the wage gap comparing mothers and childless women with men and women. Why don't you elaborate on that?
Women have made great strides in the workforce, and young women now have virtually closed the wage gap with young men. I'm talking about people under 35. However, if a woman has no children, she has almost eliminated the wage gap with men. If a woman has a child, the gap between her income and that and a childless woman is greater than the gap between young women's income in general and young men's income.
What does that say to you?
Well, it says that mothers have much lower income than anyone else, and it's saying that motherhood is the key factor keeping women's earnings down.
And why is it doing that?
Not so much sex discrimination anymore. It's more discrimination against mothers.
Why are mothers earning less?
There is a wide range of factors here. One of the ones that struck me in some of the reporting I did is that we have a climate in the workforce now where people are working longer and longer and longer hours. And people with family responsibilities simply can't work those kinds of hours. So they often just don't accept jobs in many, many industries or many, many workplaces where they know they can't be home in time to see their kids, they can't get home in time for dinner or anything else. So they're being excluded from a lot of places. Secondly, we have a lot of mandatory overtime going on. Now, maybe with this current slowdown, that'll start mitigating. But I interviewed several people, and there's a lot of cases floating around where people were asked to work maybe 10 hours a day. These are people, single mothers with kids, and they simply couldn't do it, and they were fired. So that's another. And it's a situation where if you have a child and you have a family, you have another job. You really have two full-time jobs. And there's just no way mothers can compete with that kind of situation.
So you think a lot of mothers aren't hired because the employer knows that they can't work around the clock like a childless woman might
well,
be able
to?
Well,
they're not as desirable employees in the eyes of many employers, I think.
Have you calculated what you gave up financially when you became a mother in 1982 and left your job shortly after?
Yeah, I do. I explain that in the book, and it turns out to be very typical. You can estimate that the average American college graduate who has a child will probably forego about $1 million in lifetime earnings. That's how much less their earnings would be over their lifetime if they didn't have a child. And that's mine is a little less than that because I didn't have my child. I only have one, and I didn't have him till I was over 40. So I had already had some work life. But I lost, let's say, a minimum of 15 years. I went part-time. I did part-time writing, part-time work for the last number of years. And my income was close to $1 million, lower than it would have been had I stayed at the New York Times where I was.
Why did you decide to give up full-time work?
You know, it took me by surprise. I really didn't plan this. And again, it fascinated me interviewing and other mothers that you really don't expect several things to happen when you have a baby. One of the biggest surprises is how incredible the emotional attachment is and how you just fall madly in love with this child. A lot of mothers use the phrase besotted, and I became besotted with my baby. I just could not imagine going back to work. In my case, the job I had was more than an eight-hour-a-day job. It was a really quite demanding, stressful, you know, high-pressure workplace, and I just couldn't see doing it. But I never thought it through because I had never had I didn't have the experience before. But when I had the baby, I just could not imagine going back. Now, that's a very, you know, personal thing, and not everybody feels that way. But I think certainly what I heard and what I've read and all the research I've done, most mothers would absolutely like to be home much, much more with their infants than they are able to be.
How did it affect your identity to stay home and no longer be able to identify yourself as a journalist with the New York Times?
Well, it is a job to reintegrate your identity, I think, as a professional, the way we define professionalism, and as a nurturing, caring person. You're on a different time frame. You have to move much slower, much more patiently. You can't be under pressure. You can't demand that I'll do this and that. You know, you can't have that workplace time frame. So you have to integrate a lot of very different things, and I found that was quite a challenge. But I think the hardest thing to adjust to was the outside world's perception, because I was like maybe totally hopelessly naive, but I thought, my God, I've got this incredible thing going here. I have this beautiful child, and I'm raising this child, and I was extremely proud of what I had done. I was proud of my work as a mother and proud of what I was doing, and I say never was pride so struck down, because it was as if I had vanished in the eyes of many people. I did not have the same stature or the same status as I had had earlier. And that's, you know, maybe a function that I was in Washington, which is one of the more credentialistic places on earth. And it was the early 80s when people were putting on their shoulder pads and the women were marching off to battle on the corporate wars, you know, and there was, I think it's much, much more baby-friendly now than it was then. But still, it's quite a change in status. But as I say in the book, I knew that I had to write about this one day when I was at a party and someone said to me, "Didn't you used to be Ann Crittenden?" I said, "Oh, my God. You know, I still am, but..."
Now, you know, we've been talking about the things that women give up financially when they become a mother, things that working women give up when they become a mother, particularly if they decide to stay home with their child for a short or a long period of time. What are the ways around that? I mean, you know, everybody has to make tough choices, and you can't be home full-time and in the workplace as well. So what are the ways around what you describe as the mommy tax?
I think we have a tendency to say, well, the mother has this obligation to find a personal solution, and all the women are always seeking, you know, my personal solution to this. How am I going to cope with this? And I really don't think individual women can do it. I think we're going to have some really sweeping changes. I think we're going to have to make some, have almost another movement to say, look, we've got to have a workplace situation that enables women to have some income or to maintain their careers on some level without this all or nothing. We have the most all or nothing situation in this country. You either go back full time, many people, or you are almost forced to quit. It's only 20-something percent that work part-time at all. As somebody once said, we have more choices in breakfast cereal than we do in good part-time jobs. We need a much more vigorous part-time labor market with benefits prorated to the part-time hours. In Holland, they decided they wanted to do that, and they did it. They now, a third of all jobs in Holland are part-time jobs, and they have the same benefits and as every other job, only prorated to the amount of hours they are. And we need some really serious structural changes, I think. I think we need a shorter work week. I don't think people with families should be ordered to have mandatory overtime. There are a lot of things that are, you know, we really lag behind other developed countries in being a family-oriented country. We're very unfriendly to families, really.
You like some of the policies in France. What's happening in France that you think we should be taking note of?
Well, France is notable. I think in the news this week, France is really notable for the fact that they just said half of all political candidates have to be women. The women were making very little progress politically in France, and they finally said the only way to do this is to require every political party to run as many women candidates as men. So that's going to revolutionize French politics. But as far as family supports and valuing motherhood, the French are most noted for being having a superb child care system. They have early childhood education beginning at 3, so that in effect their public schools begin at age 3 with nursery school. Not as long a day, but then the French working day is not as long. So the French now have a 35-hour work week. So those two things, if you have a 35-hour work week, which, by the way, is spreading in Europe, and you have nursery school, free quality nursery school for everyone, you know, women are in heaven. It's extremely easy for women to have a job and to have a family and to have time for both.
You also say that in France, every mother, rich or poor, married or single, receives free health care and cash allowance for each child.
Right. A lot of European countries, of course, they all almost have free health care, which we do not. Even for children, all our children aren't covered yet. And they almost, many of them, offer cash allowances, which are payments. I like the French system. They just pay, they write a check, and the British do the same. They write a check to the primary caregiver of the child. You get that check, and you can spend it any way you want. It's your allowance. And if the mother's working and she needs better daycare, she can spend it that way. If she's at home, she can spend the money on whatever, on diapers or whatever she needs. So it supplements the income.
My guest is journalist Ann Crittenden. Her new book is called The Price of Motherhood. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Ann Crittenden. She's the author of the new book, The Price of Motherhood. Let's look at Sweden. What kind of help does a mother get in Sweden?
Well, I'd always heard Sweden was a paradise for mothers and children, and I thought, well, skeptical journalist, number one, is that true? And two, if I find out it is true, I sure do want to know why. So I went over there, and I guess what? It was true. They really do have an amazingly pro-family set of policies. One of the things I discovered was they have some of the things I've talked about, so we don't maybe want to go into it too much. They have daycare, maybe not as comprehensive as the French, but they do have subsidized early education. They have a year's paid leave, and the men, the fathers, can, of course, take any portion of that, but 1 month of it has to be taken by the father only. So they guarantee that the father is going to be home. Most of the fathers take 2 months off. They take one summer vacation month and add it to their father leave, so they have 2 months off with new babies. And the mothers get 11 or 12 months off. So that's pretty good. And I interviewed these young people who were sitting there talking about, you know, this is part of life. And I interviewed one young woman who was about ready to go back to work, and she was talking about how she was going to negotiate with her employer her schedule. And it was, by law, any parent has the right to an 30-hour work week. They can work four-fifths of their normal work as long as the child is under school age until age 6. They can do this. So she knew when she went back she could negotiate either a 4-day week or a 6-hour day. It depended on what was convenient for that workplace. But that was her statutory right. So she was bargaining with her employer with the law on her side.
Has there been any opposition in Sweden from employers, you know, from the corporate world, from businesses who have felt that giving new mothers a shorter work week, giving them a year's paid leave and then a shorter work week when they return to work, would compromise the business?
Well, one of the interesting things is I did not detect so much of that in Swedish companies, but everything is multinational now. And one young man who was going back to a flexible work schedule said, you know, he said the German companies and the American companies have very little respect for the Swedish way of life. I thought that was a fantastic comment. He found that the big multinational companies were tough. in that respect. He was a management consultant, so he had a little more ability to be independent. But of course, I think the major multinationals don't like this, and that's why they fight it so hard in this country, and why we don't have it. But and there's been a debate in Sweden whether the fact that women have so many benefits as mothers, and motherhood is subsidized to an extent, doesn't hurt women in the job market. But I interviewed a number of Swedish economists, and there's just no evidence that they have any less stature in the job market than American women in terms of rising to high positions. It seems to be pretty much the same. And, of course, they have very much higher incomes than American women because they don't have to lose their jobs. They don't leave their jobs. They don't have to because they have nice long leaves, paid leaves. Whereas here, as I said earlier, many American women just have to quit in order to do the right thing or what they want to do with their children.
Journalist Anne Crittenden is my guest. She's written a new book called The Price of Motherhood, Why the Most Important Job in the World is Still the Least Valued. One of the concerns that we've talked about is that women who leave work for a short or a long period of time to stay at home and take care of their child or children, they lose a lot of money in Social Security. What would you propose to compensate for that?
Well, one thing we're not talking about is marriage. In other words, this is not a book saying we should be like Sweden exactly, or we should have more government necessarily, or we should. My point in this book is that no institution puts any material value on this huge amount of work that women are doing. And that includes marriage, a private institution. So that if a woman or a mother or father, for that matter, although it's very many fewer people, they cut back on their paid employment in order to do the work of the family. They become extremely dependent on the family, and they are dependent in marriage. So then it becomes extremely important that marriage is an equal partnership. And as the book goes into great detail to describe, that marriage is not, under in any American law, an equal financial partnership, an equal economic partnership. And that is one of the most serious obstacles to women's economic security, equality, to children's well-being. It's really bad, I think.
What kind of financial changes would you like to see in marriage and divorce law?
Well, I mean, most people who are married do believe they're in an equal partnership, that one spouse, they may have a division of labor, they may not. Most people have a division of labor. The money brought into the household does not belong to the family. It belongs to the person whose name is on the check. And if there is a divorce, that person leaves with the income. And they are not required by law to share a certain portion of it. There are child support laws now, but the child support laws are set very, very low, and they don't meet a fraction of the expense of raising children. One of the statistics that just blew me away in looking into this is that something like 40% of divorced women have to go on welfare. And we're talking, in many cases, middle-class women. So that, to me, is one of the biggest issues we need to address. So most women are impoverished by divorce. So I would argue that we need something like a two-tier marriage system where if people have no children, we would have pretty much what we have now, which is you get married and you have your own income and no one else has a really ultimate claim on your income. You're really two individuals living together and you merge certain things, but not everything. But if you have children, I think marriage ought to kick into a higher gear. All the adults' income be joint family income until the children are 18. So that people couldn't divorce. They could divorce each other, but they can't divorce their children, which is really what happens a lot.
Let's look at another aspect of the system that you say penalizes motherhood, and that's the tax code.
Yeah, mothers are the most heavily taxed workers in America. As you know, we tax married people's income jointly, so that the so-called second income is added to the first, and the first dollar on that second income is taxed at the family's highest marginal tax rate. If the two were taxed as individuals, the mother's income, let's say, would be there'd be zero taxation on her first $10,000 under the current code. So there's this huge penalty of tax, and then most women do the calculation. And as I go show in the book, it doesn't matter if you're very high income, you're in a very wealthy family, or you're in a really, really low income family. The calculation comes out the same. It really doesn't pay to work. And I had some interviews with and quote from Republican, Democrat, no matter what their persuasion, economists agree that the American tax code is the most, it just heavily discriminates against women. And it's one, Michael Boskin, who was on the Council of Economic Advisors under the first President Bush, put it, he said it pushes America, it pushes women out of the labor force. So that's something that I think people could be aware of and do something about.
Ann Crittenden is the author of The Price of Motherhood. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.